Hello, you're listening to The Sower, a podcast of the Ciceronian Society. The Ciceronian Society equips and encourages Christian scholars to serve the church as a center of cultural and civic renewal. To learn more about us, our events, our journal, Pietas, and to sign up for our newsletter and make your tax-deductible gift, go to ciceroniansociety.org. I'm Josh Bowman, Executive Director of the Ciceronian Society. Before we begin, I'd like to open us in prayer. Dear Heavenly Father, we just thank you for this conversation, for the blessing of the classical and Christian tradition that we're going to speak of today, especially the classical tradition. Lord, we just thank you for the gift of that and how it has shaped our society and the world we live in. As you bless our conversation, and all we say and do would bring glory and honor to you. Amen. I'm grateful to be joined today by Commander William Spears. Commander Spears is a submarine warfare officer in the U.S. Navy, with service as the weapons officer of a fast attack submarine and the executive officer of a Trident missile submarine. You're officially the coolest person on the podcast. He is also a scholar writing on topics of leadership and military ethics. He is author of the recently released book, Stoicism as a Warrior Philosophy, which examines the morality of war and military service through the lens of Stoic philosophy. And that book is our subject today. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks a lot, Joshua. Really appreciate being here. Hey, before we get down track, I do need to say, for the benefit of the audience, because I am actively serving in the military, it's important that I note that I am here just speaking as myself, William Spears. Anything that I say doesn't constitute an opinion of the U.S. government or any part of the government. If I don't say that, then like I'll render an opinion on Taylor Swift or something like that, and that'll suddenly become the Navy's opinion.
Oh man.
So just anything I say here is just my own dumb opinion. And you know, I'm kind of a rogue writer here. And even though I have a real job as a, you know, submarine officer in the Navy.
You broke one of the unofficial rules of the Sower. You said Taylor Swift. That's not allowed. I don't know.
Oh man. Just kidding. We gotta start over now. We gotta re-record.
And we'll have to cut that. I'm actually curious. After I read that, I just read that bio and I thought to myself, what in the world is a Trident missile submarine? I don't know how much you can say about it, but so we have a fast attack submarine and a Trident missile submarine. I mean, for us lay folks out here who just think those sound cool, what in the world are you talking about?
Well, they sound cool because they are cool. They're about the pinnacle of technology that you can have out there, but they have a very, very serious and sober mission. Mm-hmm. So a fast attack submarine is what the majority of your country's submarine fleet is. Mm-hmm. And those are, you know, all of our submarines are nuclear powered, which gives them, you know, basically unlimited range and speed, or a high rate of speed from which they can transit from point to point. Mm-hmm. An attack submarine's mission, what it is designed to do, is to find and kill submarines, you know, enemy submarines that are presenting a threat to the country, or they can sink surface ships as well. We haven't done any of that. We haven't sunk anything since World War II. Mm-hmm. But you know, the ability to do that arguably deters a lot of, it basically presents a complicating factor in your adversary's planning calculus that deters them from things that they might contemplate. And whenever you get into that idea of deterrence, that leads you into the Trident missile submarine, which has a floating missile battery of very, very big missiles that do exactly what you think they do. Yeah. And its purpose is to basically be unfindable and undetectable, so that if anyone wanted to basically paralyze the country, and this was basically, if anyone wanted to do a catastrophic strike against the country and wipe out all of its ability to retaliate, you've always got these submarines out there that can't be found that can come back the other side. And so it's kind of the sober mission that is, it's basically a one ship nuclear war. Mm-hmm. And you don't ever want to wage it kinetically, but it's doing its job. Every time, you know, people say like, well, we've got all these weapons that we don't use. Well, they're used every day that they shaped the decision space of world leaders. So that's what a Trident missile submarine does.
Well, I have to imagine being in that environment, or having that responsibility of being on a submarine like that, is probably shaping some of why you wrote this book. What's the longest you've ever been down there?
Well, you know, I've been away from home for you know, greater than 6 months at a time. That's a deployment. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you'll break up a deployment with a port call here and there where you get parts and food and you know, you're in for a few days and you get back out there. I've been underwater, you know, I think around 90 days at a stretch. I've definitely known people who've been underwater for longer, you know, and once you're, when you're out there, you're so busy that you don't really, you know, the time think just about. Kind of all blurs together. Mm-hmm. So the moral, you know, consequence and the moral weight of the decision making, it doesn't weigh on everybody. There's a lot of people who's just like, it's just the job. I focus on, you know, I run my drills, I run my, you know, tests, I, you know, do my maintenance. And that's never worked for me. I've always been one of like, well, I'm going to think through everything. And if you tell me like, oh, don't really think about it, then I'm definitely going to think about it. You know?
Yeah.
And, and at the end of the day, I personally, you know, there's a whole spectrum of political beliefs on this, and you know, lots of reasonable people can disagree. I do think that, you know, we have to have a nuclear deterrent, and I think that a lot of geopolitical stability follows from that. But it's a very, very paradoxical thing, and I honestly don't write about the morality of nuclear deterrence. Like mm-hmm. it's just a different library of stuff that many smarter people than me have written on, so I don't really touch that in my book or anything. But it's a very interesting like digression. You could do a whole other podcast
on that. Yeah. But I think there's, you know, there's something to be said about, because your book is focusing on Stoicism. We're going to get to what that means here shortly. But there's also this, you know, Stoicism is a philosophy that helped, you know, from the ancient Greeks on, helped people think about what is the right thing to do, right? How do we reason well? How do we act in accordance with nature, of course? How do we live virtuously? You know, I think I'm not a military historian. I can't claim to know a lot about that life, right? I've never lived it. It's not in my family, at least not in my lifetime. But there's, you know, a soldier doesn't have to be mindless, right? As someone who is in the military, Navy, whatever, you're not just a cog in a machine, you know, part of an algorithm, a part of a formula, right? You can think through, why in the world am I doing this? Right.
Yeah. And really you have to.
Yeah.
This idea that like a super soldier is someone who's just blindly obedient. I kind of, mm-hmm. you know, I touch on that in the book a little bit. Like that's science fiction. That's not real. Yeah. You know, like the real world is much more complex than that. That someone who's mindless like that is a strategic liability.
Right. Yeah.
Honestly.
Yeah. And if you're mindless, I mean, think of all the times you could, I can't imagine the situations that a soldier could be placed in where, what could possibly, where you're in a situation, you say to yourself, what could possibly have prepared me for this? Right. But you have to be, you know, this is one of the gifts of philosophy and history, right? History may not repeat itself and the questions may not show up the exact same way that the Stoics asked them, but there's a sense in which the problems, the occurrences, the situations, they rhyme, right? Historically, where, okay, well, maybe there weren't submarines when Alexander the Great is fighting, but some of the same questions that came up for Stoics in that era, or Stoics in the Roman military, they're still gonna be present here. So let's jump in here. So the book is called Stoicism as a Warrior Philosophy. I guess, and we've already started to answer this question, but I wanted to start here. Why engage in this project at all? Why did you start down this road as a commander in a submarine?
So I got into Stoicism when I was at the Naval Academy as a young guy, you know, in my early 20s, and it really resonated with me. And there's kind of always been an undercurrent of it there due to a particular heroic admiral who was a figure at the Naval Academy, independent of anything having to do with Stoicism, but he also happened to be deeply into Stoicism long before it was, you know, there was an internet and there was a popular Stoicism movement, any of that. And, you know, Admiral Stockdale is his name. You know, you could do a whole other podcast series on that guy. He's absolutely fascinating. But I discovered his writings whenever I was there. And I was like, man, this is just exactly how I think about everything. And, you know, years later, I would mature a little bit and realize like, well, no, I disagree with the Stoics on this and that, but it's still very fascinating. And that's the way philosophy is supposed to work, is you're supposed to engage with it critically. you know, but somewhere 10 years later, after I got really into it, it kind of blew up in the popular sphere and became this whole like cultural movement that I'm sure, you know, you've seen some of it. You can't go online without seeing, you know, how help stoicism is going to help you, you know, cope with your emotional, whatever, you know, it's a popular thing right now. And if you go to the philosophy section of a popular bookstore, Barnes and Noble or something like that, 2/3 of it is going to be books on stoicism. And most of them are going to be very, very, you know, like self-helpy kind of shallow, you know, takes, not a lot of like original sources or anything like that. So, whenever I, you know, discovered this, whenever it kind of blew up, I was like, man, any day someone's going to write a book on stoicism in the military or like for the military, you know, it's going to be something stupid, probably some like, you know, how Navy SEALs use the secrets of the Stoics to be super awesome, you know, or something like that. And I was just like, man, you know, I bet I could write a good book on this. And so I kind of started working on it and I spent like a long time on it. You know, it's been, this side project, cause I have an actual Navy career, you know, it hasn't been something that, you know, I've never really been able to sit down and just work on it. And so it's been a long brewing thing, but no one ever published that book. Mm-hmm. And then, so I'm happy to publish this now. And so the title of it, as a warrior philosophy, man, that just sounds awesome. And like, it's got this cool logo with a knife on the cover and all this. It looks really cool, you know, and it is an openly acknowledged bait and switch for, you know, all the young folks, you know, especially, yeah, let's be real, you know, young men who just want to be awesome and tough and all those things. And I make the point of like, hey, you know, these factors that you admire, that you desire, these are moral factors. And what you are seeking is morality. That is what you want. And it turns out that humans have been seeking this for a hot minute. Mm-hmm. And let's explore that. And so with that precept, it explores the philosophy of stoicism. Like, it's basically in a military fashion, if I were explaining this to an admiral, what I would do is say, okay, what do the references say? And that's what we do on a submarine. You know, we say, okay, your opinion about how we should calibrate reactor instrumentation is fascinating, and I will care about it as soon as you bring me the publication and show me what the book says. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's how we kind of approach everything. And so I'm like, okay, what does the book say? What do the original Stoics say about all these things, and let's explore it, you know, as deep as we can. And that's kind of the approach. And let's present this, you know, everything about stoicism that I think is relevant to the morality of a warrior, which I define as someone who is in the profession of arms. And I try to present this in a sober, mature fashion to, you know, young, intelligent warriors. And that's the idea. I'm really kind of writing for myself as a young midshipman or cadet, you know, or young officers, that kind of that level of development.
Yeah. Now, when you decide to write about stoicism, like a lot of things, you're stepping into a, I don't know if it's a minefield as much, but it certainly is a challenge, because stoicism develops over hundreds of years, and continues to develop in some ways. But I mean, its founder, if we can call them that, I mean, we have Socrates and Zeno. They didn't write anything down. So if they did, we don't have any evidence of it. And so you're going back to these primary sources. When I'm curious, two things. First of all, who specifically did you look at? I think many people in our audience will know some of the names. Some of them they might not. And then in going back to that, what do you think are some of the core tenets of Stoicism that distinguish it from other types of philosophies that have come out of the classical world?
Okay. So to your first question of the who, mm-hmm. So you really kind of have to look at, you have to first break down the history. It's basically like kind of a 500 year history, mm-hmm. In ancient Greece and then Rome, you know, and you've got the early Stoa, the middle Stoa, and the late Stoa. Mm-hmm. The early Stoa is Zeno, like you named, as the founder. But the key dude is this guy named Chrysippus, who is, you know, two leaders of the Stoic school departed from Zeno. He's the third leader of the Stoic school. He wrote a ton, of which we only have scraps and fragments. But, you know, so-called Orthodox Stoicism is really Chrysippean Stoicism. It's Chrysippus is his name, you know, and he is kind of the second founder of Stoicism. You've got a number, basically, you've got a number of leaders of the school, and then it dissolves when Athens's philosophical scene kind of dissolves in the Mithridatic War and everything, and it scatters to places like Rhodes and Alexandria and all that. And then Stoicism pops up as a popular philosophy in Rome 100 years later. And it is from those late Roman Stoics that basically this anyone who's quoting Stoics today, it's going to be some of the Roman Stoics. And it's going to be basically three guys, Seneca, Epictetus, or Marcus Aurelius, are your three key Roman Stoics. And you've got a couple other ones, Musonius Rufus, Heracles, you know, and I talk about them in the book too. But those three, Seneca, Epictetus, and Marcus Aurelius, are kind of like your core. And I quote from each of them extensively. And you know, I talk about it in the intro that I kind of, if I'm going to take a liberty here, it's going to be to treat it all, the whole school is kind of a monolithic thing, because there are core beliefs that just kind of don't ever change throughout the history of ancient Stoicism. And there's some that do. And I acknowledge like their political beliefs and kind of what they believe is the right way to run a society that evolves dramatically, you know, over the course of the three periods. But the basic tenets really don't. The key concept is, you know, it's not about emotions and being emotionless and all that. And that's what a lot of people will think it is, because Stoic has kind of become an adjective for being unemotional. But that's really not it. That's kind of a side effect of what their keystone concept is to focus on virtue. And it is that virtue is the sole good, what they mean. And by good, what they're talking about is that which merits my attraction or merits my motivation, you know, something that I should seek and pursue. Virtue is the sole good. And if it's not virtue, it is indifferent or something that is effectively irrelevant to my ultimate happiness. So if virtue is the sole good, it is both necessary and sufficient for happiness. And, you know, so in the Stoic view, a truly wise person can be happy in any situation as long as they're virtuous. You know, and so their happiness is completely contingent on their virtue. And so from that follows the idea that anything that I might be emotional about is effectively a judgment call for which I am responsible. So if somebody insults me and I'm angry about it, you know, that's not really that person who has made me angry. It is myself. It is my own judgment about this event that has made me angry. And so that is my fault. That is something for me to correct, because if I know that virtue is the sole good, I know that whatever insult this person has levied on me is not really reflective on my virtue. It does not express my virtue. It is an indifferent, and it is neither good nor bad. It is not something that merits my emotional response. And so that is the kind of basic idea, and that's from which they get their reputation for being, you know, calm and collected and not very emotional. Yeah. So I hope that kind of captures it.
It gets
all
to it. Yeah. And I think I'm just thinking of other things. I just thinking of they have a weird metaphysics, and their notion of God is kind of a logos, right? That kind of idea, or, yeah, you know, acting in accordance with nature. But the virtue side is particularly important. I think it's one of the things that comes to mind, because Cicero himself has a weird relationship to Stoicism, for lack of a better word. I mean, he certainly draws on them and is influenced by them deeply, but he's a mixture, right? He's a mixed bag of that. He certainly in his essay on friendship, I think to a point reflects that. He seems to think that you have to achieve a kind of Stoic level of virtue to be friends. that's a different podcast altogether. But I'm wondering why this would matter to the warriors, as you're defining them, because again, we don't want the mindless soldier, that myth of the mindless soldier, right? We already talked about that. I'm wondering, you know, in looking at this, what's the alternative? If we're not going to be if Stoicism is not the warrior philosophy, what's the alternative warrior philosophy? Right.
I mean, well, you know,
I mean, I mean, there's a lot of ways to go about this, right? I mean, there could just be, Well, I don't want to suggest them. What are you contrasting it with, I should say?
Yeah, so that's a good point. Like, I haven't been asked that before, because basically my argument is that insofar as anything is a warrior philosophy, Stoicism is it, and that's a contentious claim there. And basically, I'm looking at, things throughout history or fiction even. It's very popular in fiction, the idea that there's going to be these like warrior mystics,
The
like
Jedi.
the Jedi. The Jedi are the best example. I swear, like, the Jedi are like a fictionalized version of Stoics. And the Logos, if you just substitute the Force for the Logos, it just suddenly makes sense,
Right, the active principle and the
Yeah. It just suddenly, like, everything that Yoda's talking about, you're like, oh, he's talking about the Logos, Yeah. So I don't particularly contrast it with anything. That's just kind of not the argument. The argument is that insofar as anything is a warrior philosophy, this is it. And basically, in that, it cultivates the virtues that you desire, the specific qualities that you desire in a warrior are particularly emphasized within Stoicism. That includes equanimity, resilience, honesty, all those things. Now, these things are all human virtues, and that's kind of another point that I make throughout the book, is that what we call martial virtues are just virtues. Someone who is cowardly, would not make a good warrior, but he wouldn't make a good human either. Or someone who is not resilient, someone who is whatever, that all the qualities that we define as being essential to being a warrior is essential to being a human. And you could talk about, like, well, what about savagery and bloodthirst and all those things? And those are liabilities. Those are not qualities you want in a warrior. Whenever you have that in a recruit, that's something that like, oh, that guy's going to cause an atrocity. Let me train that out of him. He's going to require some extra training before it creates a giant strategic liability for my entire operation. And that's just if I'm not looking at it from a moral standpoint at all.
That's a question I do not know the answer to. If I were to go to the Naval Academy or any of the military academies, would you, I mean, I'm guessing you don't take a class on Stoicism, but are you, is there a philosophical part to the education of an American soldier?
It's going to be different for an enlisted soldier or sailor or something like that, and an officer. And I've been both. I went from being enlisted to being an officer. And as an enlisted guy, you barely touch on the ethics stuff, but basically you're trained, like, hey, and this is kind of a new phenomenon. Michael Walzer, who's a very important, just war theorist, writes on this a little bit of, like, hey, this is a big deal in just the moral progress of the species, that it is very common now for, the military of advanced societies to be trained even at the most basic level of, hey, you're supposed to disobey unlawful orders. So you look at something like, everyone knows about the My Lai massacre, from Vietnam, and people come into the military and they say, like, I don't want to be a baby killer. And they, they're told, like, well, good, because you're not supposed to be. And if you were to receive orders to go in and slaughter a village, you are supposed to disobey that, because that is an unlawful order according to the law of armed conflict, all these things. And in fact, if you just look at that, if you just isolate that case historically, that was a massive, just erase all, just table all the morality of it, and you just look at it from the strategic achievement of your objectives. That was a huge catastrophe, for the entire political motive of the war, just like the Abu Ghraib scandal in Iraq. Huge catastrophe that completely set back all the, just objectively, having nothing to do with morality. So yeah, your junior sailors and soldiers and all this, and Marines, they're all trained at the very basic level. You don't obey unlawful orders. But that's a very tough thing to for them to do that evaluation. And the legality of it, and I'm not a lawyer, but you get into the questions of, like, what is manifestly illegal, and as opposed to something that's nuanced. And really, the burden is on the commander to give orders that are not on the line. But anyway, to your question, the difference is, as an officer, yeah, you take some ethics classes. I took some law of war classes, some law of the sea classes, and a basic military ethics class that was very interesting to me, and I kind of pursued it. I didn't really get to take any electives of choice. Like everything had to be engineering related because I was a mech-e major throughout until like my senior year, at which point I took a, you know, basic philosophy elective, just because I was interested in it. The ethics class that I took was, you know, it's an intro to deontology and consequentialism and defined command theory and various things. And that leads into, you know, we touch on Augustine and Thomas Aquinas and things like that, that are influential on the morality of warfare and that whole construct of philosophy.
Yeah. Thinking about a couple of questions come up from that. How do you relate? I mean, maybe that's not the right word, but when you think of just war theory, right, which I'm assuming is part of that philosophical education, I've always thought of it primarily as a Christian tradition, right? But if I'm not mistaken, there is in some ways that's you could look for pieces of it even prior to Saint Augustine, right? How does Stoicism intersect, I should say, with those questions of a just war?
Well, so the tradition is Christian in origin, but the ideas stand alone. Like you can be a humanist, you can be an atheist, and still agree to the basic precepts of the morality of war that were basically systematized by Aquinas. Mm-hmm. You know, but before Aquinas there was Augustine, and before Augustine there was Cicero. Mm-hmm. And Cicero is kind of my role model as a philosopher.
That's, you know, the right answer. I'm just kidding.
Well, that's how I found your podcast.
That's, you know, right. There
I'm,
you go.
Like, I'm like looking for stuff on Cicero. I'm like, there's a society, and you know, what is this? I'm like, oh, this is a great podcast. You know, so Cicero is not a Stoic. He's basically a Stoic adjacent. He admires the Stoics, but he's his own dude, you know. Mm-hmm. And he's admits that. And he's, you know, he's formally an academic skeptic, but he's an eclectic, you know. He's going to take ideas, and he's proud of that. He says, you know, these people aren't my masters, they're my guides, and I'm going to, you know, take what is an idea I agree with, and I'm going to interact with it and engage with it. And so a lot of what we know about the Stoics comes from Cicero. And but I also argue that a lot of his philosophy reflects kind of the middle Stoics. He's influenced by middle Stoics, particularly Posidonius, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think we don't really have their much of what they wrote, but we have a lot of what people write about him. And I think that his work, De Officiis, is effectively a work of middle Stoic philosophy.
And Posidonius, if I'm not mistaken, is that the one that, so there's one of the Stoics that runs away from the King Mithridates, goes to Rome, and or one of them ends up in Cicero's house. Do you know what I'm talking about? I just read this, and I didn't write it down. This is my fault.
That might be Panaetius.
Yes. Yeah. It's either, yeah. Panaetius or, which I wasn't 100% sure how to say that one. We're actually,
Hey, be clear. I'm not either. these are things I read, but I don't really interact with a lot of people talking about Panaetius, you know, every day. It's my job at the Pentagon.
Right. Right. Yeah. Bring that up at the Pentagon. People look at you funny.
Yeah. I get that a lot.
Yeah. You get that a lot anyway. Okay. Yeah. Our listeners, we haven't announced this yet, but we're starting a series on Deificii, so it'll be a separate podcast. So thank you for that introduction. Give me a chance to shout
out. I am all in.
All right, yeah, we're gonna read through it and just wrestle with it as not necessarily as experts, but as people who want to know more. So, anyways, that's a different story. So, Stoicism, you've explained what it is. We're relating it to the warrior flaw, and I like the fact that you said you weren't necessarily contrasting with anything, because I started to think to myself, like, what would I contrast it with? In many instances, you know, you end up going back to Stoicism. It'd be interesting to look at, you know, the warrior philosophies, if you will, of kind of major moments of conflict, right? I mean, the Napoleonic Wars would be a really interesting one, right? Yeah. Where to what extent was the were the competing militaries shaped by that? Same thing with the American War for Independence. Same thing with you could even look at the Civil War, right? I mean, there's certainly a tradition of Southern Stoicism as well as a kind of a Northern version, if you will. That's a different conversation. But I'm wondering, you know, you recognize this right away that in our particular moment in our internet generation, Stoicism has really caught on. And there's kind of a popular notion of Stoicism. Maybe speak a little bit more to how that has shaped, first of all, what you know about it, because I'm sure you've kind of been paying more attention than I have, and how that has shaped kind of why you're doing what you're doing.
Yeah. So there's many different kind of strains of it. And I would say the biggest and most popular strain of it is just kind of a very, very shallow kind of self-helpy kind of Silicon Valley, how Stoicism can help you be calm and, you know, maintain equanimity while you're trading your stocks or whatever. And it really has no, that kind of level of engagement with it is where most of the books that you see on the self-help shelf are kind of working at, and it really doesn't get into the virtue piece. And so it, you know, there's no potential for conflict or upsetting anyone. People don't want to read about virtue generally. You know, they want to read about how to not be emotional, especially when they're depressed because of all the reasons that make them depressed today. But, and I argue that that is a big piece of why it is so popular right now, is because people find it to be soothing and they seek it as a solution to, you know, whatever ails them emotionally. And there's a lot that ails them emotionally.
Yeah.
So that's kind of like one strain of it. And that is probably why, you know, about 75% of what you see on it popping up on your social media feed and everything is there. A lot of it is this guy named Ryan Holiday, who just pumps out another like Stoicism book every year. He's just one of those authors that just writes books that are very easy reads, kind of airport read. You can down it in you know, an afternoon, and he just puts these books out, you know, and they're fun. They're easy reads. They don't really go very deep into it, and people love it. And most people never really get any deeper than that. I don't like to engage in the whole like gatekeeping thing of like, well, if you really read the Stoics like I do, you would see this and that, like whatever, you know, people engage with it at different levels and whatever, they're going to get different things out of it. There's another kind of strain of it, of the people who want to treat it like a philosophy of life. They want to adopt the title of modern Stoics, and not necessarily all of them, but I would say most that are in this category, as a function of certain influencers within this category, like to adopt kind of a reformed version of it that basically is tailored to the modern day and is effectively secular humanism with, you know, that it's basically kind of like it's secular humanism with a little bit more of a value proposition is the way I describe it, you know, and they basically... they're explicit that, like, well, if the Stoics were alive today, if the Stoics had continued as a philosophical school into this day, then they obviously, you know, once they encountered Charles Darwin, they would know that evolution is the truth,
the logos, right? Yeah.
Yeah. And the
natural selection is the logos.
Yeah. So I guess we should back up. One thing that we didn't say is that, you know, underlying the whole Stoic worldview is this metaphysics that the universe is God, God is the universe, and it's pantheism. The ancient Stoics were pantheists, and they talk about God constantly. When they talk about God, they're talking about the wise and corporeal universe that is a, you know, living being in their worldview. And, you know, so the universe, fate, causality, all those things are God in the Stoic worldview, you know. Well, the modern Stoics, so to speak, most people who call themselves modern Stoics, following key influencers in that space, basically tailor out all that and say that, like, modern Stoics would be atheists if they had continued until this day. Now, like, I think that that's just kind of a specious claim. Like, I mean, I could just as easily argue that as soon as Stoics encountered, David Hume, that they would believe that, reason is the slave to the passions, and then their whole philosophy would be different in that way. Like, it's just a weird and arbitrary thing to tailor. You know, that's kind of part of the reason why I do not call myself a Stoic. I admire their philosophy for many reasons, but I'm my own dude. And but I'm going to accurately present what the ancient Stoics, believed, and you can take it or leave it, but let's not like change, let's not distort what they actually believe. So anyway, that kind of segment of it is, I would say, probably about a third of the popular Stoicism movement, or the people who, call themselves modern Stoics, most of which are basically secular humanists, with a Stoic, a Stoic flavor. Then you've got a smaller section of like the would-be orthodox Stoics, or they often call themselves traditional Stoics, that consider themselves Stoics. They call themselves Stoics, but they're, emphatic that they believe all the same things that the ancients believed. And, to them, I'm like, okay, well, like, what about Numa? And like the ancient Stoics had some really wacky metaphysical beliefs that like no one could reasonably agree with. Anyway, I don't really care, believe whatever you want, but I would say that they're a small minority of the kind of popular movement. By far, the biggest group of them are the ones that kind of don't penetrate very deeply into the philosophy. They're excited about it because they want to have equanimity. They want to be emotionally calm and all those things. And they see Stoicism as a path to that, and they might not go very deep into it. And they might, read some Marcus Aurelius and move on with their lives. I think that's most of it.
Yeah. That's interesting. One of the thinkers that comes up a lot in Ciceronian society conversations is a guy named Philip Reeve. Have you ever heard of Philip Reeve?
No, I'm not familiar.
He's definitely not a warrior philosophy. Let's put it that way. But he has a great book called The Triumph of the Therapeutic, and I don't want to dive into that because it's very difficult to read, and it's just something that we're interested in. But some of what you're describing to me as this kind of modern Stoic movement is Stoicism as therapy. They don't say it that way, but it's basically, because Stoicism, as I understand it, historically, classically, wasn't meant as a therapy. It wasn't about how to get the right feels. It, right, like you said, it's about following the virtues, trying to live well and trying to live right. Not about, I just want this to make me feel better, right? It's not. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a medicine, the way it's being treated by some of these movements today. And so I think it's encouraging to see that you're wrestling with that in particular.
Now, well, I'm going to push back on that a little bit.
Okay, fair.
Even in the epilogue of my book, like I quote Cicero saying, philosophy is basically therapy, it's therapy for the soul, what it is that the epilogue is talking about, the mental health crisis, and basically stepping out of the theory and saying like, why is this popular today? I think part of it is an adaptation to the mental health crisis that we mm-hmm, see right now. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's a function of the internet. I think the mental health crisis is also a function of the internet or social media or all the things, and
I think that's fair. And I want to clarify too, that I think that there's a, because I don't want to just disparage the attempt to confront the mental health crisis with empathy and sincerity and seriousness, and philosophy certainly has a place in that, including Stoicism. And I think there's another version of therapy where it's very subjective and me-centric, right?
Oh, yeah.
Where it's just, how do I feel better, in kind of this Freudian, very superficial, physically pleasurable way, if you will, where I'm just going to soothe over and ignore the problems of the world. But again, I think you're right. I think the mental health crisis, which as an educator has affected everything in education, I can't imagine what it does in the military.
That's devastating.
I mean, it's devastating. And it's a huge liability, liability for the rest of your life. I mean, not only do soldiers bring it with them to boot camp, right, and to the academy, but and then they're on the, they bring it to the battlefield, and they certainly take it off the battlefield, right? This is something that we're not doing. I mean, I'm just from the outside looking in, it just seems like we're not doing a good job thinking through and confronting.
Yeah. So like, let's table the morality piece of it and the virtue.
Sure.
And most of the stuff that you see online on Stoicism doesn't talk about virtue. Like I said, you know, people don't want to talk about virtue because, you know, that's lame. They want to talk about being calm and emotionally controlled. Well, a very interesting piece of the therapy connection is that cognitive behavioral therapy, as we know it, which is kind of the gold standard of psychotherapy, was deeply influenced by Stoicism, not just philosophy writ large, but Stoicism particularly. Hmm. You know, cognitive behavioral therapy and rational emotive behavioral therapy were, you know, basically founded by guys who were deeply read in Seneca, Marcus Aurelius, and Epictetus. And they basically took a lot of what were, you know, Stoic practices and refined them and tested them under evidence and refined them into, you know, cognitive interventions. But what they called interventions, you know, or what we would call therapy, the Stoics just called how you should think about things. Now, we have to be careful to, you know, be clear that we're not saying that modern therapists are just doing Stoicism, because, you know, therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, and its descendants are, you know, a evidence-based, refined version of kind of what the Stoics were doing that they just kind of stumbled on and figured out. I think the analogy that I use is kind of like, we understood winemaking long before we ever had any idea what was going on there. Before anyone figured out a microscope or understood microbiology, we just figured out it worked, you know, and we figured out that you could cure a headache by chewing on the bark of a willow tree long before we realized that we could isolate the active compound as salicylic acid and synthesize it as aspirin. You know, it's kind of like a ancient version of the modern thing. I think that is the analogy there. So basically Stoicism is helping a lot of people because it's basically putting in their pocket these kind of practices that are effectively what therapy also teaches you, you know, is how to sort your emotions and think about, you know, why do I think this way? Why am I reacting this way, et cetera. But that is just the emotional piece of it. And kind of part of my argument is that, like, well, you should go a little bit deeper and you get into, you know, why does it work that way? And why does that follow from the Stoic precept that virtue is the sole good? And once you, you know, dig a little bit, you realize that that's just, in their view, that would, you know, all that emotional equanimity and self-management is an expression of virtue and also reinforces that same virtue.
Now, you said earlier you do not call yourself a Stoic. So
correct.
That tells me that you see some limitations here. What would you say, and I'm wondering where this comes up in the book as well, but what do you think of the limitations of Stoicism as a philosophy, not simply for the warrior, but for a man, a woman, for someone who's just trying to live a good life?
Well, the original, and this, the Stoics are criticized this from the very beginning, is kind of they're perfectionists, and the Stoic ideal of the ideal wise person is unattainable. You know, the
Stoic
idea
sage.
Of the Stoic sage is someone who would be happy on the torture rack because he understands that's his fate and that fate is good. And, you know, they even talk about it, that this sage would be happy on the torture rack, you know, and that's okay. Well, that's physically unachievable. How's that going to help me when I'm actually being tortured? As it turns out, James Stockdale, the admiral that I talked about, was tortured. He was, you know, a prisoner of war in Vietnam, and Epictetus was very valuable to him. You know, the teachings were very valuable to him in maintaining basically his sense of honor and sense of moral agency throughout 7 years of that experience. Again, fascinating guy. You can read his writings. They're free, available on the internet. You can read his writings on Epictetus and like that. I mean, it's just a fantastic read. If you read nothing else, you can just go to the, you know, Google, Stockdale, you know, the Warrior's Triad, or, you know, the world of Epictetus, and you can go from there. Anyway, God, I got sidetracked there. So where is Stoicism not going to be helpful? I think that, you know, if my child is, you know, being investigated for a possible, you know, fatal brain tumor or something like that, telling myself that whatever his fate is going to be good, and that it's, you know, neither good nor
Right.
bad nor indifferent what happens to him. That's not going to help me very much in that situation.
Yeah.
I'm probably, you know, going to be praying to Jesus and Zeus and Muhammad and anyone else that is going to answer, you know, just to get myself through that day, you know, and all the stoicism in the world is probably not going to help me in that situation. You know, no matter what the theory says, that's just my thought, you know, I don't know, you know,
yeah.
But, and a lot of the ideas of Stoicism are, it's about like what perfect would look like, but perfect is not what we are, you know? And so it's good to think about and contemplate what perfect would look like and what a perfect person would do in the situation. If you define someone who understands virtue as the sole good, but the, you know, it's very easy to let that lead you into being emotionally cold or unforgiving or you know, it's not really that helpful in responding with grace to people who are irrational, even though the Stoics did talk about that. They did talk about, you know, dealing with people who, you know, whenever your friend is mourning or whatever, you don't go and tell them that, hey, your kid's death is actually what the universe fated, and so therefore it's good. Right. You know, even though you know that inside, you know, you should mourn with him because that's what a good human does. But internally, you should tell yourself that your friend's being irrational, you know, and like, I don't know. I don't know that's just not what I'm going to do. If my friend's, you know, kid is harmed in some way, then I'm going to just mourn with them. That's just what I'm going to do.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Yeah, it certainly has its limitations. And we could, that could be a whole other podcast on its own. I mean, there's a whole tradition of, in particular, Christian critiques of it, which I won't get into here. But I mean, there certainly is some limitations in that. They don't really have a great, I mean, the concept of grace, you know, where does that come in for the Stoics? Why would nature need grace, right?
Yeah.
What about the idea of, you know, the rationality and reason is being so fundamental to everything? Well, you know, when you reason, I mean, this is my argument in the sense that when you reason, you reason from a pre-existing, pre-rational imagination, intuition of the way the world is. Seneca says something like this about imagination being important. And I think that the Stoics are kind of moving toward a notion of the imagination, but I don't think they quite grasp it. I don't think the Greeks do. They got a little bit of an idea with Fantasia, and you see it some of that in Aristotle, but that's a different conversation. But I think I'm encouraged. I mean, I think it's important to see the limitations of any philosophy like this, right? That the world is more complicated, but it's also kind of a Stoic idea to just think about your circumstances and acknowledge that you're not, I mean, the striving for perfection, but also not, you know, recognizing it's not there. Because the other thing too, it'd be very un-Stoic to get upset about not being perfect all the time, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, Seneca talks about that. Now, one thing that I do want to circle back on that you mentioned a little while ago is the kind of feeling that it's all about me, you know, my virtue. A lot of people read that as being self-centered, like you said, you know, they'll misinterpret that as being, you know, this kind of navel gazing philosophy that, you know, my indifference, or, you know, my virtue is what matters and everything else is an indifferent. Well, part of virtue, what expresses virtue is the justice is one of the four cardinal virtues, and the cardinal virtues are deeply embedded in Stoicism, you know,
right.
And heavily emphasized and justice is nothing if not about outward looking to everyone around me. And the Stoics were very much social creatures, you know, and they were very deeply deep believers in the ideal wise man as being kind of a pillar of the community. The ideal Stoic sage is not some like hermit in a loincloth on a mountain somewhere issuing platitudes. He's a pillar of the community. He's involved in politics. He's involved in whatever, you know, is going on around him. He's a part of it and he's participating. And that way they're kind of, their descendants. They're basically like a better version of the Cynics, which were their philosophical forebears. You know, Zeno was trained by Cynics, and the Cynics also believed that virtue was the sole good. But the cynics did not leave any room for indifference, where I could prefer, you know, a preferred indifferent over a dispreferred indifferent. I could prefer wealth over poverty, you know, or I could prefer, you know, sickness or I could prefer health over sickness. The cynics basically just believed that all indifference were distractions and virtue was the sole good. And so they deliberately impoverished themselves. Mm-hmm. And they basically, as a result, they kind of lived on the fringes of society. And they were kind of these vagrants that basically just kind of had to beg for food while they sat there in the square and criticized everyone around them. And they were critically flawed in that respect. Is it, you know, their philosophy could never subsist at scale because it didn't really create a functional member of society. You know,
kind of like critical theory, but I don't know. We don't need to go down that.
Yeah, we don't need to go yeah. there. Well, but it is kind of like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Thinking of, you know, I mentioned critical theory, and we think of the culture war question. You know, one of the, if someone reads this book, I should say, are they going to look at it as left coded, right coded, you know, in the culture war, for lack of a better term? Because Stoicism doesn't necessarily immediately jump out to me as, well, this is a conservative philosophy, or it's liberal philosophy, or it's a,
yeah,
you know, whatever. And certainly folks on every part of the spectrum have read Stoics, have referred to them. And, but I mean, you're publishing this book on as a warrior philosophy, and your audience is the military in particular, though not only the military. And mm-hmm. it's certainly at a time where, you know, how you answer that question, left or right coded, is going to determine how it's received. But I get the impression you're not aiming for something specific. You're not aiming to plant a flag on either side or here, right? So how would you address that, you know, where your argument, where Stoicism right now fits in that right, left
yeah.
mess?
Well, Joshua, you know, obviously if you read the Stoics like as deeply as I do, you would see that they agree with me on all of my political.
Well, clearly.
Which right. is what everyone will tell you.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so
yeah.
so that is, you know, my point there is that it's kind of a Rorschach test, you know, or an ink blot test, and where enthusiasts of Stoicism are going to read into it whatever, you know, support for their political beliefs.
Yeah.
And I'm not innocent of that. You know. And I mean, I'm basically arguing, and part of what I'm doing is kind of responding to some of the influencers out there basically react negatively to, you know, the military, Stoicism being popular in the military. It's like, oh, the military is abusing this philosophy and twisting it into justifying, you know, the horrible things that the military does, because we all know that the military is evil. And you know, part of, I read that and I'm like, okay, well, first of all, the military thought Stoicism was cool long before Silicon Valley discovered it, and therefore long before you discovered it. Mm-hmm. Secondly, you know, okay, if you're going to say that the military profession is incompatible with Stoicism, well, okay, let's go to the sources and see what Marcus Aurelius, the wartime general, had to say about that, you know. But anyway, so my point there is that there's going to be support for kind of a lot of different views. What we can say, though, is that Stoicism is inherently, you know, it is absolutely against being victimized. You know, there's nothing more antithetical to Stoicism than the idea of being a victim. And grievance has no place in Stoicism. It doesn't make sense to be aggrieved. No one, why would I worry what these other people are? Why would that offend me? Why would I care? You know, fear and loathing, basically all the things that make our kind of modern political moment as horrible as it is, it are all things that are antithetical to Stoic ideas. And so, regardless of whether you see it as left-coded or right-coded, I believe it is anti-radicalizing. Mm. It definitely filters out a lot of that just garbage. And if you take modern political discourse and you just filter it out of, you just take away the victimhood, the grievance, the fear, and the loathing, you just take all that out, you filter that out, what you have left are like reasonable disagreements between reasonable people that actually need to get discussed.
Yeah, you know, and actually. That, right?
Yeah, and actually merit discussion, and so I think it's a force for good in the world, and for that reason. One point that I think a lot of the military that read my book might interpret it as being kind of a lefty left book because of the cosmopolitan aspect
What do you mean?
of the Stoics. So the Stoics were cosmopolitans. They
What do you mean by
basically
that?
so a cosmopolitan is the is someone who it means basically citizen of the universe, citizen of the cosmos,
Okay, gotcha.
And you know that's an idea that the Stoics inherited. You know, the I think the earliest person to quote the you know Diogenes the Cynic said that he's a cynic of the or he I'm sorry he's a citizen of the universe. You know, and the they were the Cynics were forebears of the Stoics, but the idea is that I am, you know, I'm a member of this family, I'm a member of this country, I'm a member of all those things, but I am ultimately a member of the human species. You know, the city of gods of men or the cosmopolis, the idea of there basically being two cities. There's the physical worldly city that I'm a member of, Rome or Athens or whatever that, you know, what have you. And, you know, the city of gods and men, which is the universal cosmic city of the species. And you know, there are some key quotes that would lead you to believe that the Stoics are properly anti-patriotic, like Epictetus, for instance, says, you know, why would you call yourself a Athenian or a Corinthian? You know, you might as well call yourself a citizen of whatever corner of the room that you were born in. You know, it's an arbitrary point of loyalty or fealty. You know, why not call yourself a citizen of that which is most sovereign, which is, you know, the universal, the species that you're a member of. So that idea, a lot of people will, you know, balk at that, but I basically devote a whole chapter to, you know, why that idea does not necessarily mean that I shouldn't be patriotic. You know, it means I shouldn't be a jerk about it. You know, I shouldn't think that being an American makes me better than, you know, a Spaniard or whatever.
Right. But what about, let me just bring it back to a very Ciceronian society theme, though, and I want to close with this question too, if you have any last things to point out, is with that cosmopolitan nature of the Stoics, that's interesting because doesn't that, in addition to maybe undermining a patriotism, like in the Epictetus case, does it also undermine a sense of place, right? In the sense that can we love the local and still be stoic? Can we love the particular, you know, is the stoic does the stoic naturally gravitate to the universals rather than to the particulars? Can we love the local, the place, the particular without doing damage to the belief in universals? This is a very old Greek question, right? The kind of the tension between universals and particulars. Does the Stoic basically plant his or her flag on the side of the universals and against against localism and the place? I mean, is that how would you respond to that?
So I argue no,
Okay.
and I argue against people, and there are plenty of people who say that, you know, a Stoic by being cosmopolitans would properly not consider themselves citizens of the United States or whatever the country is. I say that's bollocks, you know. And if we look at the evidence of, you know, Marcus Aurelius, Seneca, Cicero, who, you know, is a deep admirer of the Stoics, extremely patriotic, you know, but these guys also said, but I am also a citizen of the universe. And the idea is it's basically treated as dual citizenship, where if I properly understand what is good, then whatever is good for myself, whatever is good for my local community, and whatever is good for the universe, the universal, you know, species, all those things are going to be consistent. And recognizing and looking for and seeking that consistency or that coherency is going to help me navigate what is good, recognizing. But I don't cease to be a member of my family just because I'm a member of the species. So I also don't cease to be a member of my country. It's kind of my point there. And you know, like this tension between communitarianism and cosmopolitanism, you know, being a good citizen of my community, being a good father, being a good whatever, and being a good citizen of the universal community, Those things don't have to come be in tension, or they don't have to pose from one another. Recognizing and seeking the coherency between those two can help me navigate these moral dilemmas. But if I don't treat my own kid any differently than I treat, a kid that's a starving kid on the other side of the world on a different continent, if I treat them both the same, then I'm probably going to be a pretty crappy father. My kid actually like deserves certain attentions that what is appropriate for me to give to this one person is not necessarily the same as it is appropriate for someone else. And that's a very tough dilemma. Humans have been struggling with it for a hot minute, but it doesn't follow from the idea that I'm a member of the human species that I must treat my kid no better than, or pay no more attention to them than some kid on the other side of the world. At the same time, I can recognize that kid on the other side of the world as a human being and properly deserving of some level of my consideration. So it's a tough dilemma, but I think I address it.
Excellent. Well, Commander Spears, I really enjoyed this conversation. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Yeah. Hey, Joshua, I really appreciate it. If I can leave your listeners with like one thing,
Go for it.
kind of the signature, and this is the one that I kind of like to leave everyone with. I signed my book with it, is Cicero's quote. So Socrates, would go around Athens doing the Socrates thing of asking these impossible questions of what, one of them is, what is good? And you say you think you know what good is. Okay, well let's diagnose that. And what the dialogue, it comes around to the idea that what is good is what is both honorable and useful, is the idea of something that is good. An act is good as if it is both honorable and useful. Cicero in De Officiis chapter 3, he gets into, well, if we know that something is honorable, then we know it must be useful. And if we know it is useful, we know it must be honorable. If we really know what those things are, we know that they are consistent with one another. And if it is not truly honorable, then it is not truly useful. It is going to bite me in the butt at someday. I'm going to regret it. I think that that is a very useful and powerful sorting mechanism for moral dilemmas. And I try to teach it to everyone that I can in the military. Whether you're running an organization, you're leading, you're following, whatever it is, if it is not honorable, then that thing is not useful. And I think that that is a very useful and powerful quote. So anyway, if there's one thing that anyone will take away, I'd recommend it be that.
I love it. Thank you so much. I appreciate it, Commander.
Yeah, I really appreciate being here, Joshua.
Thank you. You've been listening to The Sower, a production of the Ciceronian Society. And if you've enjoyed this conversation, we certainly welcome any conversation on Cicero, the Stoics, and all this stuff. We hope you'll consider signing up for our newsletter and joining us for a future event. We'll be having our 2026 conference at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, March 12th through the 14th. Sponsorships opportunities are still available. Be sure to rate and review this podcast, share it with your friends, and check out our website at ciceroniansociety.org. Thank you for listening.